Blog Talk Radio. Good morning, everybody. This is your partner in success, Denise Griffiths. I am an online entrepreneur, I'm a virtual assistance industry expert, and I'm a web developer. Today, I want to welcome you to the Online Entrepreneur Audio Interview Series. I've created this audio series to provide you with practical guidance from very successful entrepreneurs to learn their key secrets as to how they build and grow their online businesses. My intention for this series is to empower you to achieve your dreams and live a successful and very accomplished life. In other words, do it your way. So today I'm really excited. I have the privilege of being owned or joined by author and career coach Ford R. Myers. Ford is the author of Get the Job You Want Even When No One's Hiring. How timely is that title? That, I understand, is hitting the bookstores in just a week or two, and I'll have Ford tell you about that. Ford Myers has more than 15 years career coaching experience, and he has consulted with thousands of people who are looking for jobs and gaining jobs. So today we have the opportunity to hear him speak to the problems that so many people are facing in finding a job during a down economy. After a job loss, maybe they were laid off or their company went away, or maybe they're just looking for a new career. Ford is the go-to guy for that. Excuse me. This is a very, very important interview. And I invite you to download it and listen to it often after the call concludes. Put it on your iPod, and I promise you, you're going to find something new every time you listen to it. So, Ford, welcome to the show. Congratulations on your book. And I'm excited to see how that I'm excited to read the book, actually. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be an author and a career expert?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show, Denise. I really appreciate it, and I'm hoping to give the listeners a lot of very valuable information that they can really put to use in a practical way. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, my background, as you mentioned, includes more than 15 years, almost 20 years now, of working with people who are focused on maximizing their career success. Now, this could mean people who are unemployed or in transition or laid off or downsized, but it could also mean people who are fully employed who are just perhaps dissatisfied and looking for ways to reach their full potential. So I've worked for three of the largest career consulting firms in the world, and while I was working at these firms, I really watched very carefully to see what was working and what wasn't working. And over the years, I got a very good sense of how to do it better. So I actually left those large organizations and started my own firm called Career Potential, LLC, and that was in about 2002. And my mission was very simple. My mission was to do what the big boys were doing, but do it better and do it more effectively and basically offer much better results to the clients. So even though those big companies are very successful and they make a lot of money, I actually saw a lot of gaps, a lot of deficiencies in the level of service and quality that they were offering to the clients. So over the years, I've written quite a lot of materials and articles, and over the years also, people were asking me, why don't you put it all into a book? Why don't you offer it to the general public instead of just to your select clients? And, of course, I never really had the time, I never had the energy because I was so busy building the business. But as time went by, I realized that, you know, there was such a demand for this that I realized I just really had to sit down, pull together my materials, rework it, and put it into the context of a book. And this took some time. It took a lot of time, actually, but I'm happy to say that all that's behind me now. And here we are approaching June of 2009. The book is just coming out now. I'm very, very excited about it because now, really, I truly can make this material accessible to anyone.
And it couldn't come at a better time.
Yeah, thanks. I agree with that.
It's almost as if you were looking into a crystal ball and foretold the future.
Well, almost, but it was certainly fortuitous. Everything did come together very, very nicely.
And I can't wait to read it. I'm really excited. I've read the excerpt, and it's a very powerful book. So
thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I really want people to read this. It's a phenomenal book from what I can see of it. One of the things that you just mentioned, that you had worked for the top three career companies, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
What major mistakes, and I know you've seen them, what major mistakes do you continually see job seekers make? I mean, what prevents them from getting the job that they really, really want?
Well, it's a long, complicated answer, but I'm going to try to crystallize it for you. There are just so many mistakes people make, and the thing that listeners have to understand is I don't blame them. I don't think it's their fault, because the truth is that in our society, we don't teach people how to manage their careers properly. You can go through 12 years of primary school, 4 years of college, even graduate school, and never have a single day of training on how to manage your career or how to make career choices, how to do an effective job search. No training at all, no background, no support. And I think it's just crazy the way in our culture that there's just no grounding, there's no context. And it's amazing that people get as far as they do, because it almost seems so random when people are even successful. If you actually sit down and ask them, how did they become so successful, they often can't even answer you, or they'll tell you that it was pure coincidence, mm-hmm. or they happen to meet someone someday who said, oh, you should try the banking field, or some silly thing like that. You know, guidance counselors, well, we've all been through that. We know how that is in high school. And college isn't much better. So, I don't blame people for this, because there just is no learning opportunity, or unless you really seek it out, like career counselors or people of that nature. And very few people avail themselves of those kinds of services, especially when they're young. So to answer your question about mistakes, I honestly think that the biggest mistake of all is when people are not totally clear, not totally focused on the kind of career or job they really want. There's this myth that you should cast a wide net and you should look for just about anything where you can get an offer. I completely don't agree with that. I'm a big believer in planning, in thinking through a strategy. I'm a big believer in following through on your goals and your objectives. And I think that people need to be laser focused. They have to have a very, very clear idea of where they belong, what they really want to do, where they can express their talents and skills most effectively, and what differentiates them from everyone else. If they can answer those kinds of questions, they'll do much, much better instead of just kind of, you know, wandering through this vague, amorphous, you know, thing we call it a career. And I'm talking about a career with a lowercase c. When you talk about career with a capital C, that's the kind of career I want people to have, where they're more in control, where they're more on top of it, instead of their career being on top of them.
So they're passionate about what they're looking for. They're excited. They want to get up and go to work every day. They want to bring their A game to their employer. They're not just scattershotting and taking a job that comes along to pay the bills.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, they have to be engaged. You know, a Gallup poll, a very popular research organization, did a study about 2 or 3 years ago. And I actually quoted it in some articles, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was some outrageous number, something like 86% of employees who were asked the question answered by saying that they were not engaged at work, that they were just biding their time, that they weren't really fully expressing themselves, that they didn't feel really aligned with the position that they held. This is terrible, and it translates into literally billions and billions of dollars of lost productivity in corporate America. So if we take the corporate side out of the equation and just look at the individual, it's just plain sad that so many people are disengaged. We're talking a huge percentage of this. The majority of people in jobs are disengaged. They're not fully functioning. They don't even really care that much about what they're doing. I think that's very, very sad and unfortunate.
It is. And there are other effects that take place when you're that miserable, when you're that disengaged. Your health suffers. Your relationships suffer. Your self-esteem suffers.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just the job search, I don't think. I think it's just, it really speaks to your all-around health, if you will. But if you're just not doing something that you love or that you're engaged in, that you really, really are passionate about.
Well, you're right. You're exactly right. And even the term job, if you think about the term job, even that little word with three letters has almost a negative connotation in some mm-hmm. circles. People joke about it. You know, they say, oh, job, J-O-B, just over broke. And they laugh and they joke, but it's really very cynical and it's really very sad. You know, people look at their job as though it's a sentence many times, something that they have to do, something that they're you know, required to do just to pay the bills. And that's just a very bad state of affairs. What people need to do instead, in my opinion, is turn it over completely, flip it over, so that work becomes an extension of who you are, your greatest gifts, your greatest passions, and so that people can really, truly get engaged, much more productive, much more content, and they'll feel so much more excited and alive as they go to work. So instead of dreading getting up and going to work in the morning like so many people do, I envision a time when most people will be able to feel excited and get out of bed, and they won't even think of it as work. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that old saying, which I believe was actually attributed to Confucius, which says something like, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's something like, if a man finds his passion, he will never have to work a day in his life.
Right. I think Dolly Parton said it, but it might have been Confucius.
Yeah, well, I think Confucius probably stole it from Dolly Parton.
There you go. When she says it, it just sounds right.
Yes, yes.
But you're absolutely right. And you know, when people love what they do, and I mean, my career, if you will, is, you know, I work in my own home office. I don't have to go to a job any longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember so clearly coming across people in the hallway or in a break room, and you'd say, "Hey, how are you doing?" "I'm okay." Oh my gosh. Those people just wear you out, and you have to wonder why they even bothered to get dressed, brush your teeth, get in the car, and go there.
Well, it's almost like they leave their... I know exactly what you mean, Denise, and it's almost like they leave their soul at the door.
Yeah.
When they walk into the building to go to work, you know, it's just very, very sad. Now, again, we're not talking about everybody. Clearly, there are people who do love their jobs and love their careers. But I have to say that, as I mentioned before, it's almost like they got there by accident in so many cases, or just by luck. And what I try to do is make this entire process more conscious, more deliberate. I try to make it with clients, help clients to actually find what they really want to do, make a plan to get there, make it happen, and feel like they really own their career, that they're much more in charge of their career, and they feel so much more excited and more engaged and more productive.
And how do you do that? I mean, I know that there's several steps. Does your book cover this?
The book covers all of this and much, much more. The book is, you know, the title of the book is Get the Job You Want Even When No One's Hiring. And that's obviously very topical and very appropriate for today's job market and our terrible economy right now. But people shouldn't be fooled, because this book is evergreen. This book has all the strategies and tools and resources for any time, no matter what the career, what the economy is doing or the job market is doing. But it does have a particular slant. The book does definitely discuss what are the specific strategies that you must employ in a bad economy and when no one seems to be hiring. But the entire content of the book can be applied anytime, no matter what the economy is doing.
Right. If you're in a job or a position that just is not who you really feel that you are, this
mm-hmm.
book would be perfect for you, so you can laser focus and go find what it is your passion is and where your niche is. So let's talk about resumes. Being a virtual assistant and a web developer, I just automatically somewhere along the line fell into the role of being a technical writer as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a mandatory requirement in my fields.
Mm-hmm.
I get now more than ever, I'm getting a lot of requests to write resumes, and I'm turning them down. I turn those, you know, I really prefer that people go to professionals to get those written. I have heard you say that, contrary to popular belief, that, you know, when people are thinking that the resume is their most important tool, am I correct here? You say that the resume is not the most important tool?
Well, that's exactly right. I go even farther than that. I tell people that their resume is their least important tool. And people always look at me like I'm crazy when I tell them this, until I explain it. And then once I explain my thinking, every single person just says, "Oh, now I understand. Now I get it." So let me explain it briefly. You know, when people lose their jobs, their first impulse is to immediately send out 500 resumes. or to immediately go to the web and look at websites like Monster.com or CareerBuilder and start answering a ton of job postings. But all these things are focused on the resume, the resume, the resume, the resume. And again, I don't blame people for this. It's simply that they don't know any different. No one ever taught them about all the other tools that are more important. So when I work with a client, we don't start in the first day by working on their resume. In fact, we don't usually get to their resume for many weeks when we're doing a career consulting program. And again, people might think this sounds strange, but I'm going to explain why this is. If you think about a resume and think about the psychological impact that a resume has when someone receives it, what does the resume say? The resume says, I am a job seeker. I need a job. I am applying for an open position. In some cases, it screams, I'm desperate. Now, not always, but it just depends on how the resume is written. But one way or another, the resume positions you as a product and as a commodity, and it has a psychological impact of saying, I'm just another job seeker, no matter how good your resume is. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind is that the resume is filled with facts and figures, but it really doesn't have a lot of information about who you are as a person. It doesn't give a well-rounded representation of who you really are. The third thing to keep in mind is that the resume certainly does have to be good, and it has to be well-written, but I really think that it needs to be played down instead of played up in the whole job-seeking game. Now, another thing is that, as everyone has heard, networking is so important when it comes to looking for work. It's more important than ever, even though we have a technology-oriented society now where resumes are passed around and put on internet job applications and so forth. The networking really still needs to be the core of your search. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take all these factors, pardon me?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. That old saying, it's not what you know, it's who you know. When
it yes.
Comes
well, that's very true. It's very true. So if you take all this information I've just mentioned as a foundation, then you say to yourself, well, okay, if the resume is not going to be the most important tool, then what is? And why should I hold back my resume? Here's the answer. Every job search professional, meaning career consultants and coaches like me, we all know that the best way to find a job is to uncover an opportunity that hasn't even yet been posted. In other words, to not be one of 500 applicants for an open position, but instead get there sooner, uncover an opportunity before everybody else does, and try to position yourself as the only candidate. So if that's true, then the resume really goes down the list, not to the top of the list.
Right.
And so what tools should you use? If you're networking, in other words, and you're uncovering an opportunity that no one has heard about yet because you got there first, then the resume is not the appropriate tool. The appropriate tool is something that we call a one-page biography. A one-page bio is just like it sounds. It's an overview written about you and your background. It's written in the third person so that you don't say, I do this and I've done that and I went to this school. Instead, it's written in the third person so it says, Denise is a virtual assistant. Denise went to this school. Denise's strengths include A, B, and C. So it's written in the third person. It's written in paragraph.
Like a press release?
It's sort of like a press release.
Okay.
I'll tell you what it's even closer to. If you've ever read a novel and on the back of the book, it has, like the whole back of the book or the very last page of the book has a one-page overview about the author,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, right. That's about the closest item that I can mention that sort of matches the tone of the biography that I want my clients to write. So if you're networking, which is obviously the way that you uncover these opportunities, then the appropriate tool to use in a networking meeting is the bio, because it sends a different psychological message. A bio says, I am a well-qualified individual. I know my value, and any company that gets to work with me will be very fortunate indeed. Whereas the resume, as I said before, it sort of screams, I'm looking for a job, I'm out of work, I have to find a position.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different psychological message. And so what we do with clients is we create an entire portfolio of tools, job-seeking tools, self-marketing tools, that are much more important and more effective than the resume. Now, does the resume come into play at all? Yes, it does. I'll tell you exactly when. When there is an actual position that you're applying for, let's say it's through a recruiter or a search firm or an employment agency, or maybe you do see a position online that you want to apply for. You know, there's nothing wrong with that as long as you do it very selectively. So in those cases, you will use a resume. Or if you're at an interview and the interviewer says, do you have a copy of your resume for me, or can I have another copy of your resume? Then sure, you need to have a great resume. But in my world, the resume comes very late, and it's played down, played way down. Instead, we use these other tools like the biography, and there's a lot of other tools as well.
So basically, the resume would be, you know, once you've made it to that first interview, assuming that you have located the job that you really want, that not everybody and their grandmother knows about it, you have, you know, talked with somebody, you've gotten in the door, then your resume comes into play.
Yeah, it comes. That's right. It comes in late in the game. It's almost like the resume seals the deal, but it doesn't open up the dialogue. It closes the dialogue when they're making you the offer.
And, of course, it lists all of your core competencies and all of the different places that you've worked, which truthfully is probably not of much interest until they've really figured out if you're a good fit.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And I know what listeners are going to be thinking. They're going to be saying, yeah, but human resources asked me for my resume. What am I supposed to do? Or I'm applying for these jobs online, and they insist that I send in my resume on the form. I understand all that. I've been down this road 50,000 times. But there's ways around these things. Again, you want to differentiate yourself. You do not want to come off as just another job seeker. You don't want to be in a pile of 500 resumes that aren't going to get read anyway. It's a very different mindset when we send our clients out to do a job search. They're pursuing a very different approach, an approach that I dare say is far more effective.
I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in positions where I would walk into an office, you know, when I was working in a corporate environment, and I would walk in, and I promise you, the resume envelopes would be stacked in stacks.
Uh-huh.
And there might be what looked to be hundreds of them, but most of them never got opened.
No, you're
they
exactly right.
Did not get opened. What I witnessed, and I know that you have spoken to this, was somebody who knew somebody, was a friend or a cousin or, you know, just somebody who knew somebody got the job. Those resumes were almost worthless.
Yeah, and wouldn't you like to be the one who gets the job? So in other words, you should be the friend of the friend, or you should be the cousin, or you should be the one who was referred by another executive in the organization. Those resumes are often done only as a formality. It's almost like a legal requirement in many cases. But here's the big secret. Most employers already know who they're going to hire even while they're posting the positions, because they have to do this often for legal reasons or to look politically correct.
Well, and not only that, but they also, you know, may decide, well, you know, I'm not quite sure. Let me see if there's a better candidate.
Yeah.
And most of the time there's not, but it's a game, and it's kind of a vicious game, I think.
Well, I agree. And so one of the things we do when we work with clients is to open their eyes to what's really going on instead of what they think is going on.
Right.
And again, I don't blame them. It's just that no one ever explained it to them.
Well, you need to start a school.
Yes, right. Yeah, the Career Coaching University of America.
There you go. I think it's time. So what is the number one secret? We've covered a lot of information here, but what would you call the number one secret to job search success?
Okay, well, I used to say that the number one secret had to do with something we already discussed, which is having a laser focus on exactly what you want to do and what your true gift is and what you want to be doing for a living and what your contribution to the world is going to be. And that's still critically important. But because of what's going on in the world right now with the worst job market in 60 or 80 years and a terrible, terrible sinking economy, I have another number one strategy now that I think needs to be said, and that is this: to do an attitude adjustment. So number one secret in my book right now is to do an attitude adjustment, or to put it differently, to take a very, very close look at your attitude and assumptions. And I can explain what I mean about this, but to me, that is number one priority, because no matter how good your tools are, no matter how smart you are, I don't care if you went to, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton, none of this matters if your attitude and your assumptions are not working in your favor. So let me talk a little bit about that, and I'll explain what I mean, okay?
Yeah, I would love for you to. And I really like what you said a minute ago about what your contribution is. I think a lot of people go into an office environment or, you know, go into an interview or hope they're going to get the interview, and all they've done is the math. They've done the math. I need to ask for this money. I've got to get this to cover my bills. They don't even consider what they're contributing.
No, and the irony is that people, you know, you talk about money. Well, money is important, of course. But what people don't understand is that their pay will be in direct proportion to the level of their contribution and nothing else. So if they want to make more money, that's very nice. But the only way that people can consistently earn more money is if they consistently contribute more.
They bring value.
Right.
They're not just showing up with their coffee mug.
That's right.
Okay, well, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that really struck me. So.
Well, no, that's perfectly fine. So let me talk to you a little bit about this attitude adjustment.
Okay.
Let's look at what's going on in the world right now. If you watch CNN or any news program, if you read any newspaper, if you go on Yahoo News or whatever, any place you find out about the outside world, what do you see? Nothing but sensationalism, cynicism, negativity, fear. And, you know, that's fine because that's what sells newspapers and magazines, and that's what gets people riveted to the television screen. So I understand why they do it. But isn't it funny that CNN and all these other outlets don't talk very much about when things are going well or when things are improving or when there are big opportunities coming around the bend? So my point here is to really watch what is shaping your attitude and where your assumptions are coming from. What you really need to do is an honest assessment of your own state of mind and your underlying feelings. Even in the book that I wrote, by the way, the very first sentence of the book says, yes, the job market is bad, really, really bad. Right? That's the first sentence. So I'm not sugarcoating it. You know, believe me.
You wrote that a long time ago. I mean,
and I wrote that when I knew what was going on or what was going to happen in the job market. But the point is, I don't sugarcoat it. I don't try to pretend that everything is rosy and perfect. That's not my point. My point, however, is that even in this terrible market, people are still getting good jobs. Some people are still landing wonderful opportunities. Some people are moving forward and getting raises and promotions. And even while every company is firing or laying off, they're also hiring people in the back door while they're throwing people out the front door. So this is some of the things people have to understand. So are you going to pay attention to the negativity and cynicism, or are you going to pay attention to the people who are doing well and thriving?
I think that many people just say, oh, my God, you know, everything is going to come to a stop. It's over. It's done. It's not. Look around you. People are working. People are still driving through McDonald's windows.
People are still
ground to a halt.
No, you're right. So which category do you want to be in? You know, I have one client who was very funny. He said to me, he said, Ford, for me, there is no recession and there is no bad job market.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I don't do recession and I don't do bad job market. It's not in my it's not in my vocabulary.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's the kind of person you want to stick with, not the negativity and cynicism and the doomsayers. So you've got to do an attitude adjustment. You've got to really do an honest assessment of your own state of mind and your underlying feelings. Look inside, look in the mirror, and ask yourself, are you living in a state of fear and low self-esteem and anxiety? Are you thinking, oh my God, my life is over, I'll never work again? Well, if you are, then it's time to really question those assumptions and be very, very careful about the underlying feelings you're bringing with you, because I can tell you that every employer can smell your negativity and your cynicism a mile away.
Yes, they can.
And people you network with, people you ask to help you, will not get on board with you if you're coming off as being negative and cynical about your chances. So the number one biggest secret of all is to really, really do an attitude adjustment and watch what your assumptions are, because no matter how good you are at everything else, if your attitude and assumptions and your emotional state is negative, you're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and that is so true. You know, I'll be on teleseminars with people who will say, oh, well, you know, I just can't get clients. I just can't do. And I'm thinking to myself, well, of course you can't. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Listen
That's right.
to yourself.
You're
That's annoying right. me, so God knows what you're doing to your clients.
Yeah,
and
there's
I don't
that
look
old.
Like you.
Well, I agree. There's that old saying. It goes something like, if you think you can't do something, you're right.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, in my world, there's no such word as can't,
mm-hmm.
and there's no such word as if. It's always, you know, if is substituted for when,
mm-hmm.
and can't is like, well, I may not want to do it, I won't do it, but doesn't mean I can't do it.
Right, or how can it be done?
Exactly.
These are the better questions.
Exactly, exactly. So I know a lot of people personally right now that have been laid off due to cutbacks, and I hear this all the time. It's like, oh, I don't understand. This shouldn't be happening to me. I've got double masters. I work hard. I showed up every day. I didn't take, you know, vacations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't deserve this. What's going on? And these people are angry.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly I think they're hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're genuinely, their feelings are hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you address that?
Well, you make a very good point, and you're absolutely right. Hurt and, you know, rejected, and their self-esteem has been battered.
Mm-hmm.
This is personal. In other words, the feelings are personal, no question about it. But ironically, at the same time, what has happened to them is not personal. Let me tell you what I mean. If you're part of a company and there's a downsizing and you're one of 500 people that gets let go, is that personal? Of course not. All right. If you're part of a company that goes bankrupt and goes out of business and you're one of 1,000 employees, is that your fault? Of course not. So even though the feelings, the impact can feel personal, it's not personal at all in most cases. You know, my clients who come to me have not been fired. Most of them are very good at what they do. They don't get fired because of incompetence or what have you, or for breaking the rules. What happens is they get laid off or they get, displaced because of what's going on in their industry. So people have to separate the event from the emotional impact that it has. And as soon as they do that, they tend to start to feel a little bit better. Now, I know what you mean about people who have worked very hard, they've always shown up, and they're angry. They say this shouldn't be happening to me. This is for other people, not for me.
Right.
Or, you know, I've seen people laid off on television, and once heard of somebody who got downsized, but not me. This shouldn't happen to me.
Right.
Well,
it's the alternate reality. It doesn't really happen in your world.
Exactly. But that doesn't hold water anymore. It doesn't make any sense anymore because in this economy, in this job market, every single person in the country is impacted either directly or indirectly. Think about your own family. Think about your own friends. I guarantee you that if you think about it, there's going to be some friends or some family members who have been impacted by this economy and by this job market. And so, you know, everyone is touched. And it might even be you. So my point here is that instead of wallowing in anger and frustration, people need to just accept it as a fact of life in today's world, and they need to move on. They need to recollect themselves, and they need to strategize and put a plan together and move forward, not backward.
I'm seeing some people in my part of the country, you know, we're heavily oil field related, and a lot of jobs have been lost down here. Some of these people, I kid you not, are taking it almost as badly as they would a divorce.
Oh, absolutely. It does feel like a divorce for some people.
Yeah, it must. I mean, they're very angry. They're, you know, they're upset. I have one girl that she works with me. She said, my husband has taken to drinking. Oh, my God.
Absolutely.
That's the wrong thing to do.
No, look, you're right, Denise. Let me be clear. In my office, there's a box of tissues right next to the table whenever I see clients. And I'm going through about a box a week.
Oh,
all right,
wow.
That's what clients are doing when they come into my office, men and women. So believe me,
yeah.
I know that this is personal. They go through these tissues one after another until I've never seen so many boxes of tissues going through my office because people are very, very, very upset. Sometimes people drink. Sometimes people commit suicide. Sometimes people, you know, break up marriages. This is the fact of today's world. But show me a case like that, and I'll show you a person who doesn't and hasn't been managing their career. Because one of the...
And chances are they haven't been managing their money.
Right, exactly.
If the impact is that quick and that sudden and they're so panicked about paying mortgages and how, you know, car notes, chances are they're not in a very good financial position either, and that has to exacerbate.
No, you're right.
Already a tough situation.
You're exactly right. But listen, look at the contrast. Take a person like that, all right, who has, let's say they've had the same job for 25 years, the job gets eliminated, and they're panicked. Why are they panicked? Because they feel like they don't have any other options. They feel like they're not prepared to do anything else. They don't have a network. They don't know about other opportunities or other jobs, and on and on and on and on. Contrast that to a person who has been managing their career well or has been through career coaching, and what do those people say? I'll tell you what they say. They say, well, all right, so I lost my job. Well, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's no big deal because my network is alive. My materials are up to date. I know my strengths and my options. I can make contact immediately with a lot of other opportunities, and I'll land on my feet. It won't take very long. I'll have to look. I'll have to go through some interviews. I'll probably have some disappointments, but eventually I'll land something good, and it probably won't take all that long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never a good thing to lose a job, but I'm saying that it's a difference between being absolutely devastated versus simply experiencing a temporary inconvenience.
Right. Well, and I agree with you. I mean, I have actually seen that around here too. You know, people who are just saying, well, you know, they have that attitude. They say, well, you know, I liked my job, I enjoyed it, but this isn't the end of the world for me.
That's right.
I'm going to go do something different. And they always, always land on their feet because, like you said, employers can smell the fear. They can. They're not going to take you if you're so desperate that they just don't know what kind of loose cannon they're getting.
Absolutely right. And, you know, an applicant or a candidate cannot afford to have that negativity surrounding them. It's almost like in the cartoon, you know, where they have the black cloud above the person's head,
yeah,
and everywhere they walk, the dark cloud stays above their head.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the employer sees. And, you know, people are not as good actors as they think they are. They say, well, when I walk into the interview, I'll be positive. I'll act more upbeat when I get there. No, that doesn't work. This has to be 24 hours a day. This has to be down in your bones. This has to be a complete shift in attitude and assumptions. Otherwise, you don't even have a chance.
I agree with you. I've seen it time and time and time again. So when somebody, we're going to continue in the layoff vein, and I suspect, Ford, that we're not going to have enough time to cover all of the questions that I have for you.
Sure.
In fact, I'm convinced because as you're speaking, so many different things are popping into my head that I know people need to know from you. Can I get you to come back on another date if we don't get through it today?
Of course, I'd be happy to. Look, it's a big subject, and there's a lot to say about it, and I'd be very, very happy to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So, you know, getting back to my question, what are the first five things that someone should do right away after being laid off?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand they're going to go home, tell their wife, and kick a door or something.
Or kick the dog.
Yeah. What do you do after you've kicked whatever it is that you're going to kick?
Well, okay, we already talked about the biggest thing of all, which is the attitude adjustment, and to be very careful about your assumptions that you're living with about your career and your job prospects. But let's talk now about five other strategies that I think are very urgent, things that people need to attend to very, very soon after they lose a position. So the first thing I think is for a person to do a career inventory. This means, again, looking inward before you look outward. So instead of rushing home and applying to 50 jobs, you need to just pause and sit with yourself and look into the mirror and be reflective, introspective for a moment. And this is what I call doing a career inventory. So this is where a person looks at where they've been in their career, where they are right now in their current situation, and where they think they'd like to go moving forward. So this is about establishing new plans. It's about setting goals. It's about actually writing out your job search strategy. This is step number one. This is what people need to do, I think, immediately or at least a couple of days after they lose a position. After that, I think the second step is to get your career documents up to date. You know, look at your resume And if you don't have the other tools I've been talking about, then start to develop them, whether it's the one-page biography or writing out your accomplishment stories or creating a target list of companies that you want to go after, and, of course, the resume as well. And there's about 10 or 12 different tools that we work with clients on. So,
do you have some place on one of your websites that you can send people to find these tools or at least a list of these tools?
Yes, they can go to the website, which is careerpotential.com, and they should poke around and look for something called the Job Seekers Toolkit, which is one of the articles.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. And then a third strategy that I think is really, really important is that everyone, and I mean everyone, should seek help and get some support. So whether you're a CEO or a waitress, I don't care. You need to get some support and help. Now, this could be on the one end hiring a career coach like myself, and on the other end, it could be simply going to the library and reading up about career management and job search. There are many, many seminars. Some of them are free. Some of them are paid. There are government and municipal agencies that help people find jobs. There are certifications that people can take. There's training. There's job search clubs and groups. So whatever it is, whether you're going to hire a career coach or do the other things I'm mentioning, get help, get support, concentrate on learning, read, ask questions, and get out of your own head. Get out of your own limiting capabilities and expand your capabilities. Open your eyes to all that's available out there in terms of knowledge, information, support, and help. You know, it reminds me of the old saying, don't try this at home. Well, this is sort of like, don't do this alone, okay?
Right.
Okay, so...
And network. Get out and network.
Well, yeah, that's certainly part of it. I'm going to get to that in a second. Strategy number four is, after you do a little bit of this learning and enhancing your skills and your abilities, then number four is to practice. Practice, 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 practice. And what do I mean by this? Well, obviously, the person is going to be doing some networking. They're going to be doing some interviews, and they're going to be doing some negotiation. And so these are the three primary things that people generally are not really good at because they haven't been doing it a lot. So what this means is get someone to practice with you, whether it's a friend, a spouse. You can use a tape recorder. You can use some kind of digital gizmo to record your voice. But I think the best approach is to work with an individual, a friend or a spouse, and actually practice sort of role play on networking, role play on interviewing, and role play on negotiating. And come into the meeting, or the practice meeting anyway, with, like what do they call those things? Cue cards or a list of questions so that you can practice over and over again and so that this behavior pattern becomes second nature.
Right.
Okay? Now, you mentioned a second ago, Denise, you mentioned networking. So number five on my list of the first five things to focus on is to get your network in order. Unfortunately, most people really ignore their network. They neglect it when they are working. And so here's a person who's been working. Let's say they've had a job for 5 or 10 years. That's great. You know, they've made a living, and that's swell. But unfortunately, they were only looking so far as the job. They were not looking beyond the job. They didn't keep their network alive. They didn't stay plugged in to the larger business community. This is a mistake. So what people need to do now is really refocus, reengage, reestablish their network. That means reaching out to people. You can use networking sites like LinkedIn or Facebook or what have you. But mainly it means reconnecting and getting your network back up to speed. You need to have a document that has everybody's name and address, meaning their email address and their phone number. You need to call people, reach out, say, how are you? I've been hiding lately. I had a job that was all-consuming, but now I'm really starting to reach out to people, and I want to get back in touch. You can schedule coffee meetings. You can go visit people at their place of work. You can take people out for a drink. Whatever it is, you can have business networking discussions, but network, network, network. It's absolutely essential as the main vehicle through which people can find the best opportunities.
Again, it's who you know. It's not what you know.
That's right.
What you know comes after who you know.
Well, you're right. And, there's another follow-up comment I want to make to what you just said. People need to stop thinking that we live in a meritocracy. They need to stop thinking that just because they have a good pedigree, that that's enough, just because their credentials are strong, that that will carry them through their career. That is no longer the case. That is no longer the case. In today's world, having a good background, good education, good training, good work history simply is not enough. You've got to go farther. You've got to differentiate yourself. You've got to sell yourself. You've got to prove what value you bring from day one. You've got to be focused on tangible, measurable results. I mean, look, if I was hiring someone, if I had a job opening here at my firm, and if I was hiring someone, and let's say I had two top candidates, one person went to Harvard and had a stellar academic background and worked for the top agencies, the top firms, and had been just, you know, really impressive with, they've written, that's great. But show me somebody else who demonstrates actual tangible results, things that are going to build my business and make my job easier from day one. Mm-hmm. I will hire the second person, not the first person.
Absolutely.
And that's a difference from 5 years ago.
And
even 2 years ago.
And how does personality come into this too? Because I hear this a lot as well, you know, being a contractor, if you will. You know, I work for myself and the people who work with me work for themselves. And honestly, I have heard this time and time again, we will pick up jobs, or I will pick up a job, honestly, based on what you just said, the fact that we can demonstrate that we do bring value. But the second thing that is said is, I just like your personality. Mm-hmm. Where does personality come into this?
Well, it's huge, because I'll tell you another big, big secret is that employers or interviewers, they hire people they like.
Yes.
And they hire people like them. Now, that's an interesting statement. Mm-hmm. Let me say it again. They hire people they like, and they hire people like them. So what does this mean? This means that there must be a personal connection. There needs to be a sense of rapport. There needs to be a psychological bond, some kind of outreach, some kind of connection that gets forged right away. If a person doesn't really connect with you and doesn't like you or doesn't feel like they're on the same wavelength with you, then you won't get the job no matter how well-dressed you are or no matter how good your college degrees look.
Because they just assume that there's problems coming down the road, I guess.
Or it doesn't even have to be that extreme. It simply means that they just don't really connect.
Oh,
and if they're going to work with you on a day-to-day basis, you know, they need to really feel that they like you. They need to mm-hmm. want to be in your presence. They need to want to hang out with you at work. And if that doesn't make a connection, then you're not going to get the offer. Now, obviously, you can't connect with everybody. You can't have everybody love you. But that's okay, mm-hmm. because you shouldn't want a job anyway with someone that you don't like and you don't connect
no.
with.
And that is true, because you're just miserable during the day.
Right.
I mean, if you're around people that you just, for whatever reasons, just don't enjoy their company, you walk out of there wretched, and that's just not right.
Exactly right. So we're not talking about marrying these people. We're just talking about having a cordial, productive relationship during the day where you can feel respected, where you can feel acknowledged, and where you can feel that that you fit in and that you generally like the people around you. That's
mm-hmm.
very, very important. What we're
and
talking about here is
to the situation. I mean, you're not just sitting there taking up a chair.
That's
you're
right.
actually doing something that you enjoy and that your employer is getting fair value for you being right there in that position.
That's exactly right. And we can look at this connection we're talking about on a micro level or a macro level. Micro would mean, for example, you like the boss, you like the hiring manager, you like your subordinates, and you feel good about most of them in terms of relationships. On a macro level, we're talking about the company's culture. And so do you fit into the culture? Is it aligned with your own, your internal culture? Do you feel like it's a good fit? This is so important, much more important than how much money they're going to pay you.
I agree, because how many hours a day are you working?
Right, exactly.
I mean, anywhere from 8 to 10, depending. Then you've got travel time, you've got, you know, getting ready time, you've got lunch time. You spend the bulk of your day at work or on your way to work or on your way from work. You really need to enjoy it.
Exactly
you really
right.
You do. So if you're not enjoying it, I think everybody suffers. You do, the boss does, your support. I think everybody just does not do well in these environments. So that takes me to my next question. So people, you're telling me that people really need to take the time to identify their ideal job.
Mm-hmm.
What are some steps that they can do that so they don't wind up in a job where it's just not a good fit all the way around, and it's just a paycheck. I don't think most people want just a paycheck. I don't.
No, you're right.
I want to be passionate and involved with my work and my clients, and I turn away clients because I may not feel that we're a good fit, or I just don't like their projects. I'll turn them away.
Mm-hmm.
I work too hard to just deal with things that I don't enjoy. But that's a luxury I have afforded myself. That's the job I created for myself.
Well, yeah, as a self-employed person.
But I think people can do that in the job market as well.
Well, they can do it.
You correctly.
They can do it to a point, and they can do it differently. You know, you're a self-employed person, and
yeah.
So it's a slightly different equation. But even people who are working in companies, they have more say over this than they think. They have more control over this whole thing than they might realize. So to answer your question, I think there are two specific strategies that people should employ in order to determine the culture and make sure that it's a good fit. The first strategy is research. There's no lack of information about companies. They can go online to any number of websites and dig up all kinds of information, get a real sense for the company's priorities, their objectives, their history, their culture, their background, their priorities. I mean, it's all available online or the library, and they can just learn an enormous amount about a company before they even go in for a networking meeting or an interview. The second strategy is networking. Networking is a very, very rich source of the real story. So let's say, for example, you know someone who works at the company or used to work at that company. Or let's say you know someone who did business with them as a supplier or a vendor or a consultant. You can ask questions of all these people and get a good 360-degree view of what the company is really all about from the inside. And even though you may never have stepped foot in their building, you still can get a very good view of what the company is all about, what their culture is like, and what it's like to be there or work for them. And this is something people need to do before they ever go into the building. They need to also, by the way, learn as much as they can, not just about the company, but about the person they're going to be meeting with, the interviewer in most cases. And there again, plenty of information that they can gather through research and through networking to learn what they can about the person or persons whom they're going to be meeting.
Excellent. So once people have done this, and I know there are other steps. We talked about the resumes. What about recommendation letters? I mean, to me, those are fairly important, particularly if you're coming. Referrals in any business, I think, are critical.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you go to a former employer and ask for a recommendation letter?
Mm-hmm.
Should you do it? And who should you ask? And how many should you get?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question, Denise. And there's really two parts to this. They're two sides of the same coin. One is that people need a list of references. That's one page that just lists several work-related contacts from your work history from all levels. It doesn't have to be all presidents and CEOs. It could even be subordinates. But it does give people a list of people they can call and get a good input, get input about what you were like to work with and what you were like as a professional. So that's one thing. The other side of the coin, as you mentioned, is letters of recommendation. And so what we do is we have at least 3 to 5 letters of recommendation that you get from, again, people who will sing your praises, people who think you're the greatest thing. And how do you get them? You just ask. You simply say, listen, I am embarking on a new career search, and it's very important that I give the companies a sense of what I'm like from other people's perspective. Would you be willing to write a letter for me? Most of the time, people will say yes. I mean, obviously, you're only going to ask people who you think will say yes, people who like you and think your work is great. You're not going to ask people who you never got along with or who think that you're terrible. So most of those people will say, yeah, sure. Some of them might say, I don't have time. You write the letter and I'll sign it, which is fine. It's great.
Yeah.
And they should get the person to send you a draft so that you can look at their document and that you can actually do some editing or ask them to do the editing, and send it back to them to fix it up and then print it out on their company letterhead.
Mm-hmm.
And they should sign it. Here's two other quick tips about letters of recommendation. Include no date and include no salutation. So don't say, dear Bob, or don't say, to whom it may concern, or don't say, dear sir or madam. Just start the letter. Just go right into the letter saying, I worked with Denise for 3 years at IBM. She was the best technology person, or whatever, right? You understand?
Yes, absolutely.
And no date, because the date...
timeless.
Yeah, it'll date you. You don't want to have a letter 5 years from now that says 2009 on it when it's going to be 2015 or 16.
And the question is, well, what have you been doing for those 5 years, and how come nobody likes you anymore? It poses some very deep questions. I cannot believe we've blown through an hour, and I'm counting questions. I wrote down 20 questions for you.
Wow.
That's how important I think this is. And right now we're on number 7.
Wow.
So I really, really need to get you back here. And you know what I'm thinking as well? I would love to get you on a teleseminar where people can actually maybe get on the line and chat with you.
Yes, we'll definitely do that.
I would love to do that because this is so important. But I'm looking in the chat room, and the Journaling Genius is asking a question. She says, as a career and business coach, how do you convince people that you want to help, they're saying they can't afford it? How do you convince them to get the help that they say they can afford now rather than later?
Is she talking about career coaching?
I believe she is.
Okay.
Because as a career business coach, how do you convince people who you want to help?
Oh, I see.
That they can't afford not to get help sooner rather than later.
Yes. Well, she just answered her own question, but I can comment on it briefly. As I mentioned earlier, everybody needs help in this. Everybody. And so, if they can't afford a career coach, I mentioned other options that they can still pursue to get support and help. Now, when it comes to career coaching, in my organization, for example, we have 3 or 4 different options. It's not just one price fits all. So when someone says to me that they're very, very limited with their funds, we still can find an alternative or a solution that will suit their budget. That's one answer. The other answer is that people do need to understand that this is a critical investment, not an expense. This is not like putting money into the stock market where you hope to get your money back or hope to gain some return. When people invest in career consulting, it always, and I mean always, underlined 10 times, it always returns in many, many multiples. And I could let people talk to clients. I could show them pages and pages and pages of testimonials that attest to this fact. But people need to get away from this idea like, oh, God, I have to spend $1,000 or $5,000 or whatever it is, and it's a huge expense. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But look, if I said to you, give me $1,000, Denise, and you say, oh, I don't know if I have it. I might have to dig around. I might have to beg and borrow and steal. I say, okay, fine. But if you still found $1,000 and gave it to me, and if I promised you and swore to you, and if you believed that you could get $5,000 back in a month or 2 or 3, that'd be a pretty good investment. So that's the way people need to look at career coaching. It's a very important investment that really, really returns. Now, is everyone going to do career coaching? Of course not. I know that it's not for everyone. But people do who are even thinking about career coaching, they need to get away from this idea that it's like tearing up money. Instead, they have to think of it as one of the wisest investments they can possibly make in their future.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, why would you, let's just use your house analogy, why would you buy, a $400,000 house and then let the shutters rot off of it?
Well, that's right. It's amazing. People will.
Why don't you do the work that it takes to maintain?
That's right.
And get you further along. I don't understand that mindset.
And to get more money when you sell the house.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of getting more money, we teach a lot of negotiation skills. Our clients routinely get an extra $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 because we teach them how to negotiate for a much, much better package. In addition, time is money, right? And so if we are able to shave time off of a person's search, that means thousands of dollars right back into their pocket.
Right.
But these are things a lot of people don't stop to think about.
It's not a cost, it's an investment.
That's true, and I mean that in the true sense of the word.
Right. And I think if people were to stop and just take a breath after they've lost a job or if they think they're going to lose a job and listen to you and read your book and maybe attend our teleseminars, I think some of that stomach-knotting angst might be relieved.
Oh, I do too. Imagine what a relief it would be to help, to get someone to guide you and help you and show you the way and lead you by the hand and partner with you and provide a shoulder to cry on and coach you and kick you and really make you achieve your best possible potential. And to know that, you know, you don't have to do it all by yourself, but someone else who's been down this road 100 times, 1,000 times can guide you and lead you and make you feel so much more secure.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And again, that's part of the networking. It's part of the buddy system, if you will. Mm-hmm. Tell people again where they can go to get your book. I've typed out the URL in the chat room.
Okay, well, sure.
Tell people where to get at least a chapter, sample chapter of your book.
Okay, sure. They can go to the website, which is careerpotential.com. And they'll see a big picture right there of the book cover. If they just click on the book, it'll take them right to a page where they can download a sample chapter and get many other free bonuses. And they can even order the book if they want to.
Okay, great. Do we have just a couple of minutes to take some calls?
Oh, sure.
Okay, let me see if I can get somebody on the line here.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a couple of minutes. Okay, this is Denise Griffiths. I'm on the line with Ford Myers. Do you have a question for Ford?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can. It
yes.
Sounds like Judy Peoples, the journaling genius.
This is Judy, the journaling genius. Hi, Ford.
Oh, hi, Judy. How are you?
I'm great. I was actually a victim of a layoff back in 07 and ended up creating my own company. And now I'm actually a career and business coach. The question is, I know we talked about, oh, don't take it personally, it's not personal, and all of that. But what I find sometimes with the clients I work with who are also in a similar situation, I live in Silicon Valley, so there's a lot of it going on here as well as
mm-hmm.
around the country. Sometimes things pop up. You think you're not taking it personally and you're doing all the steps that you need to do, and then they suddenly realize something comes up and kind of bites them in the butt.
Such as?
Such feeling that it is personal and feeling that sense of rejection and so on. And I have my techniques that I work with them, but would you have any suggestions for those clients?
Mm-hmm. Yes. These feelings you're talking about can be mitigated significantly if they have a support system built around them. So, for example, I mentioned job search clubs, job search groups, counseling, career coaching. You know, what happens if you have these support systems is that it minimizes these extreme ups and downs. If you picture a chart on a radar screen that goes up and down and up and down and up and down, really extreme dips and valleys and peaks, that's what happens when people are not getting help and support, when they don't have a support system built around them. Now, if you take that same person and put the support around them, what happens is that those extreme peaks and valleys, they even out. So it's more like a very gently flowing line rather than these extremes. And so that's the biggest thing I can tell people, is to not isolate themselves and not to be doing this alone. The second thing is this. If they're really struggling emotionally, then there comes a time when they need to get psychological counseling. And there have been clients I have referred to therapists and psychologists because it's just simply necessary. And that's not every client. That's the rare case. But there are cases like that. And let's face it, this can get very emotional for some people. And if they don't have the right support systems and the right mindset, the way to deal is to get help on a psychological level.
Now, Judy made a point in the chat room that, and this was several questions back, but she made a point that people identify themselves with their job.
Oh, boy, that's a big one, yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah, that's a big, big one. And one of the things that I teach, obviously, is to have a life and have a career, and they're not the same. Are they related? Of course they're related, but they're not the same. I mentioned earlier that sometimes people can get so devastated, almost suicidal in some extreme cases. These are people who do, in fact, define themselves through their work. And it's like you've completely chopped them off at the knees. This is a bad, bad situation. So what's it about? It's about building balance in your life. It's about having support mechanisms. It's about having, you know, other outlets and other interests in your life other than just your work. So that if one thing falls by the wayside, the other things can still hold you up. It's like the legs of a stool. If a stool has four legs and you pick out one of them, it's not that big a deal because the other three legs will still keep you up. But if you have a stool with one leg and you kick that leg out, then, you know, you're sunk completely, literally. And so that's how people need to think about this.
Wow. Well, Ford, tell people where to get. When does your book come out, by the way? I interrupted myself. I'm so excited about
the book is available right now on the online, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble and what have you. And they can get it right on my website, which is careerpotential.com. If they just click on the big image of the book, they'll go right to the page that gives them all the free bonuses I mentioned, and they can also order the book right there if they wish.
Okay, and go back to an earlier link where people can go to get the information that we were discussing in the show.
Well, it's the same website, careerpotential.com, and if they click on articles, they'll be able to find a lot of wonderful articles, including ones that cover the subjects we discussed here today.
Okay, good. I think a lot of people need to know that they're not alone and that they can create support systems, and that really most of the time it's not a personal decision. I know around here I was talking to a gentleman who lost his job. He said that when he got called in to be laid off, his boss cried. His boss was so distraught. They had actually managed to save these five positions, I think it was, and for about 4 or 5 months, and then the word came down, no, we have to cut costs.
Yeah, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. And the boss was, I think, actually more distraught than my friend was.
Well, this is pretty common.
He was comforting his boss that I think he didn't really, until he got home and told his wife, it's just, oh, geez,
Yes. You're right.
It's hard for everybody.
It is hard for everybody.
People are not doing this for fun.
You're absolutely right, and it's sometimes very, very hard on the employer. But, again, if people will look at this objectively, if people will understand that it's not personal, then they can really move through this more easily than taking it personally. It's not the end of the world. It's just the end of a phase, the end of a chapter in your career. But as I said earlier, if you're always prepared, if you have what I call perpetual career management in your behavior pattern, then these things will be a terrible inconvenience, perhaps, but they will not be a devastating personal experience.
That's great advice. Well, Ford, I really am looking forward to having you come back because there's so much more information to cover. And I want to thank you for being here today. This has been a really great interview.
Well, thanks. It was great fun, and I appreciate it. I hope the information is helpful to the listeners.
Oh, there's no question. It will be. But there's just so much more that I have to ask you, so I will definitely get you back on the show.
Okay, that sounds great.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
So I want to thank everybody for being here, and the show will be available for download in about an hour. And this is Denise Griffiths wishing you a great day, a wonderful weekend, and I look forward to seeing you next Friday when I welcome Jack Humphrey. For those of you who follow Web 2.0 and know anything about the Internet at all, you know who Jack Humphrey is. He has the Friday Traffic Report. He's a 10-year veteran Internet marketing consultant, blog marketing expert, and is the author of Authority Black Book. So, I really want you to be here for this one. Ford, I'm looking at my calendar. Is there any way I can get you back on here to finish up this, in my opinion, really critical interview? Can I get you back sometime in June? I've got
absolutely
the 6th available, which, honestly, I don't want to go that long. I think we need to get you back sooner than that. So,
Tell me some dates. We'll check the calendar. I'm sure we can make it work.
I think we'll do a midweek show. I think we'll do a special edition. This is a really, really important topic.
I'm happy to do it.
Need to do more than one a week, I think.
Yeah, maybe so.
Well, I'm looking at my list of questions, and I'm not sure we can cover it all in one more. So Ford and I will get on the phone and work this out. So those of you who are listening, we're not done. We'll be back.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Thank you so much, everybody. Y'all have a great weekend, and I'll see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks, Denise. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.